sunsets and the ghettos play. Long nights on a hot summer's block where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices. Welcome to Spitfire, Women of Color Radio, every last Wednesday in the month on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Note on celebrating 10 years of programming.
Woo! This is our 10 year and 1 month, right? Yeah, because we started October 2002. So, Mercedes.
Tonight, we've got a great show in store. I mean, it's going to be great. I've already got goosebumps. We will bring you another edition of the Spitfire Roundup, where we share highlights from news stories outside the margins. That's right, bring those voices into the light to be heard.
Thanks, Mercedes. We will also be featuring an interview with renowned dub poet and revolutionary Debbie Young, who spoke with us earlier this month during her 333 tour through Montreal. So, yeah.
All this is coming next on Spitfire Radio, Women of Color.
And why do they try to distract we from the dirty reality of living in a disgust society? We want to know who is truly financially backing this year. Capitalism, brothers and sisters are feeling naked without our tables of labels, without our tables of labels, of labels, of labels. Boy, my friend, a revolution come to an end, an end, an end. Boy, my friend, a revolution come to an end, an end, an end. But oh, solution for done. When you walk around downtown, don't you see the urban slum? Beside the Soho, a slow-mo, beg some change and passes by, pass in by. Keep your eye straight ahead. And ho, 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 revolution for done. When beside the eating center, a sex trade worker is a woman of color. She's a single mother, she's just on the corner. She's just begging a dollar. She's just trying, 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 trying to make a living. And how revolution for done when in a disaster for we drop a rate way too high for mention. And under tension we bop our heads, the commercial gangster bop 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 bop. Kill each other off, Lord, Lord have mercy. Kill each other off, Lord, Lord have mercy. Kill each other off, Lord, Lord have mercy. My friend, my friend, my friend, revolution has come to an end, an end. Lord, my friend, my friend, my friend, revolution has come to an end, an end. And so tonight I will curl up in front the tube and watch the bold and the beautiful and the young and the restless. But I am young and restless, yes. I am young and restless, yes. I am young and restless. Revolution can't done not yet. Revolution can't done not yet. Oh, what were mothers and fathers committed to a struggle? Them never lie down, them never curl up, them never get too comfortable anywhere. Asata Shakur, Amilcar Cabral, Franz Fanon, Steve Biko, Stokely Carmichael, Angela Davis. This list is long and long. This list goes on and on. I want to watch them, feel them, breathe them, be them. They are my revolutionary friends. My revolutionary friends. Revolution can't end, cause you and you and you and you and you and me too. Feel it beating, bleeding, boiling. Blood pumping, blood, blood pumping. In our veins, we the people, we the people, we the people are the revolution, the revolution.
Welcome back. You're listening to Spitfire Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. First day of snowfall in the winter season of 2012-2013. We've got a couple of news clippings that we have come across in the past month that we want to share to you before we get into the interview with Debbie. So I love all things election, and particularly U.S. election. So I just wanted to debunk a myth that's been annoying me, that's been in U.S. media since the re-election of President Obama, which is that women and people of color came out in huge margins for the president, and that was crucial to his election. While that may be true for people of color as a whole, male and female people of color, there's this perception that somehow all women who are gendered and raced voted for Obama, and that's not true. White women actually voted for Romney as a collective. Now, you could disaggregate that and say single women voted as a whole voted for Obama, but I just think it's important to note that the media is failing to understand that women of color actually voted for Obama en masse, and that's what carried the gender gap, which people are noting as an important reason that Obama got elected. So white women actually voted for Romney by a margin of 56% to 42%, 56 for Romney, 42% for Obama. But it's noteworthy, the numbers of women of color that voted for Obama are the highest supporters of Obama. So black women were the highest supporter of Obama. They voted for him by a margin of 96% to 3%. Contrast with black men who voted for him at a margin of 87% to 11%. Latina women voted for the president by a 76% to 23% margin, and women of all other races that are non-white voted for the president by a margin of 66% to 31%. So this idea that women carried the president to re-election is true, but I just think it's important that we talk about the fact that who's driving that gender gap. It was actually women of color. And the fact that the media is failing to talk about women of color being crucial to that gender gap kind of reinforces this idea that they have no ability to really cover the lived experiences or realities of women of color. An interesting note of this came from Fox News. So there was this this guy who kind of is associated with right-wing blogs, was on the Sean Hannity show. His name is John Hopkins. He's a conservative town hall commentator, and he was featured on the Romney's campaign official blog as saying leading up to the election, he actually tweeted while he was on Hannity's show. And Hannity's show that night was a five-year anniversary of scooping the Obama kind of racial controversy of the first presidential election, where allegedly Obama professed his hatred, I guess, of white Americans, allegedly, according to Fox News. But this man tweeted, a white woman voting for Barack Obama is like a black woman voting for the KKK.
Gasp. That's
that's as reported. That was tweeted as the show was rolling out. So just this idea that the fires of racial hatred are mutually exclusive along gender and race lines can't be sown, because there is still a preponderance of white women that did vote for Romney. And I just think it's interesting, because I think the reason why this doesn't come up is because there's even this divide among white women in the U.S. where educated, college graduated women who work for the New York Times, who work for CNN, maybe are more likely to be Democratic. But their sisters who are poor, who are working at Walmart, who are, you know, struggling to feed their families, like, they might have had not have had as much access to information, and might have seen the economy as like speaking to them more personally, because since Obama's been president, maybe they didn't, you know, they haven't been doing so well. So maybe they were more inclined to vote for Romney. Like, I'm not saying that I'm not saying that Romney should have won, or Obama's like worse than Romney. I'm just saying that I think it's interesting that, you know, the media is not talking about that. And it just shows once again that no matter how influential we are to a national election, we're still not part of the discussion. Yeah. So I just wanted to,
thanks for sharing.
Yeah. So Mercedes, what's going on?
So I want to kind of bring on the table the Nina Simone is Still Too Black for Hollywood article posted by Black Acrylic on November 6, 2012, so at the beginning of the month, in Culture Diaspora, Film, History, Identity, and Music. So here it goes. So it is a sad day when the legacy of a black icon like Nina Simone and everything that makes her the Nubian queen she is diminished to adhere to the white aesthetic that is Hollywood. This is what happened with the casting of Zoe Saldana in the biopic of Simone's life by Cynthia Mort and Jimmy Levine. Considering that Simone was a prominent advocate for portraying the ideals of the quote-unquote real black woman, it is ironic that of all the black actresses to cast as a representation for Simone, Zoe Saldana, a light-skinned Colombian Puerto Rican actress with prominently Western features, was cast. How exactly is she supposed to be the embodiment of Nina Simone when all that the audience sees is Hollywood's version of a black woman, a Nina 2.0, so to speak? To quote Blog Acrylic, where this article is found, the decision is part of a tradition of whitewashing the legacies of women of color in popular cinema, with Elizabeth Taylor playing Cleopatra being the most classic example. It is tragic that in America's contemporary post-racial society, it would be so outrageous to choose an actress with greater resemblance to Nina Simone that Zoe Saldana wearing a prosthetic nose, fake teeth, and blackface will have to do. Saldana on set looked ridiculous and contradicts Nina Simone's legacy. So as the article clearly outlines, it is an atrocity when we have to put actresses in blackface in order to represent this version of blackness in a, quote, open quote, perverse way of using more marketable light-skinned women for roles that require less marketable dark-skinned women, close quote. So I ask you ladies now for your take on the situation. I see like a couple of questions. So what do you think of Zoe Saldana being casted in the role of Nina Simone and the issue that this possesses?
Well, let me take it. So, like, if you guys actually go online and check out the blog where this article was posted, you can see this amazing, like, 3-minute documentary footage of Nina Simone actually talking about blackness and how it's central. Does anyone want to piggyback on that idea?
I haven't seen it.
Oh.
Can you fill us in?
Well, basically, she's all about, like, being, it's all about, like, being, like, representing blackness in its fullest form. So, to, like, this idea of having, like, some Zoe Saldana, who's obviously had to put on fake makeup in order to look darker, is kind of really controversial when clearly there should be someone who could better fit that role.
Yeah, that's so okay. That makes me think because it's almost like I have to look like a particular type of blackness when really there those features and physical appearances actually exist. So the idea that you need to pluck like a lighter skin, very skinny, very racially ambiguous looking black woman. I'm not saying she's not a black woman or she's not a woman of African descent. She obviously is. Mm-hmm. But that you don't have other examples in Hollywood to pluck from. So you take this woman who maybe is black, but what does that have to do? Like there's different types of black womanness that are out there. And the fact that Hollywood only thinks that there's this one pool that they have to draw from while still making her dress up in like in quote unquote blackface, like blacken herself, whatever that means, make herself look more quote African with, you know, a broader nose and all that stuff. When there are actually women who just look like that.
Mm-hmm. Who are
actresses. It's so strange.
And that actually segues into the next question I want to ask you guys. It's like, how does the whitening of Nina Simone through Zoe Saldana affect how black women in society are viewed? Do you believe that when black women are depicted in this way, there's an added pressure to therefore look a certain way in order to be considered a quote-unquote socially accepted black woman?
Well, it's just disgusting that, like, you know, people who are naturally black-looking can't even, you know, are not good enough to actually play the roles of black women. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have, like, you know, legitimate, you know, more legitimate women who are able to who have to pass for it's just, I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just
it's troubling. It's
very, very, it just strikes, it just shows how unaccommodating like the establishment is.
I just wanted to say too, I feel like we talk about this a lot, the way that portrayals of women of color are in media are so dehumanizing, remind us all the time of how we're thought of as not beautiful. Anything that's associated with beauty, we are definitely not part of that. But I just wanted to say more broadly that I feel like this makes these stories about Nina Simone that much worse told. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If you can't actually find somebody who based on their embodiment and their resemblance to the actual person that you're trying to tell a story about,
then don't do
it. I feel like that's bad storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, just from like a purely artistic.
Yeah.
I mean, not that you can ever take the politics out of storytelling. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying.
I mean, I agree, because even for Ray, I know they had the rights for the movie since like 1985, and the director, because he wanted it to be as true to Ray as possible, basically waited 20 years for someone like Jamie Foxx to come along, who looked like him and could play like him, etc. And it's true, like if you can't do it right, don't do it until the time is right.
And just a word, like I read that article and they mentioned how that Hollywood doesn't even have the rights from the Nina Simone estate or the family in order to tell her story, which is masquerading as a biopic, and that they're kind of flubbing up like the main storyline and turning it into a romance involving someone who was her music producer or manager who is in fact gay, and Hollywood has turned it into a heterosexual, a heteronormative, you know, heterosexual romance. So problems, lots of problems.
Oh my gosh,
it's like complete exploitation, you know, totally taking advantage, desecrating like someone's life, like an icon,
and just like a remnant.
Yeah,
totally dishonoring her legacy.
It's terrible.
We are frustrated.
Yeah. What else has been in the news this month?
Well, this October, blogger Tracy Clayton, who actually goes by the pseudonym Brokey McPoverty, wrote an article entitled "White Woman Wears Afro, Life Changes or Something." And this article sheds light on yet another blog about a white New Yorker who is undergoing some sort of spiritual enlightenment and mind-opening experience. And the woman in question is Michelle Joni, and her path of enlightenment is running around the city wearing an afro. So in her own words, what is an afro? In the context of this blog, it is the magical goodness that follows before. It's a delicious discovery of something new about the world.
Or on top of my head right now. It gets better.
It gets better.
Can you eat hair? Wow.
And she goes on to say, an afro, be it new lipstick or a new career, changes your perspective. It makes you think, walk, see, and experience life differently. Unquote. Tears. All right.
Does that mean that I should go get a white hair, like a blonde wig, and wear that?
She does do it, so that's already taken. That's already taken.
For anyone who hasn't, who's just hearing this article and hasn't read it or seen it, there's a couple of photos of this woman with the wig slash afro, mm-hmm. and one of them she's got the like Scary Spice like grrr, as because you know if your hair happens to just grow like that, you must be an animal,
yeah.
a wild yeah. like animal Amazonia. Jungle something object.
And we're not just talking about like. Little fro. We're talking about like 4 feet. I don't know. It just extends. It's like half the size of her body.
It's very hyperbolic. Yeah, definitely.
I would actually question the authenticity of her afro, because to me, afro is not synonymous with black hair. Like, afro is a particular style that's mm-hmm. from a particular era that became prominent. For example, I wear my hair, quote, natural. Like, for all the sisters, you know exactly mm-hmm. what I'm talking yeah. about. And people in my neighborhood, I live in a predominantly white neighborhood, and people are always like, oh, votre bel afro. And I question whether or not I actually have an afro. I just feel like my hair grows out of my head this way. I don't use a pick. I'm not styling it after those images. And I just, it's like there's such a dearth of representation of black hair in media, because we're always told that we have to have a specific look. And if you have that, if you have natural hair, you're not likely to be put in those positions unless they just mm-hmm. want to make you like this wild, out of control, unkempt person. So people have no, like, understanding. So when I look at her hair, like, did you see the photos? I just thought that was like, a curly wig mm-hmm. with a little bit of volume. Like, you know what I mean?
Now, the real problem with it is that she goes around the city wearing this afro to stereotypically black events. So she took it to a fried chicken festival.
It's horrible.
And this is what she says on her Twitter, quote, It was an obvious occasion to wear the fro.
Obvious, yeah. I didn't realize.
Yeah, I don't know. I find it so interesting, this kind of like I'm looking for self-discovery through like impersonating what I perceive as being black, and that's like almost like a spiritual yeah. awakening. Mm-hmm. I just find that so, I don't know. It's very foreign. That desire is very foreign to me. Like,
I don't know. I don't want to be all psychoanalytical about like race relations in the States, but like I saw this really cool movie about jazz and African American people and like race relations, and basically, the premise of the film was that, well, this guy was making a thesis that, like the spiritual, like, evolution or, like, development of, like, white people in the States is, like, totally contingent on them fessing up to guilt, you know?
Well, everything, right? So, like, rock and most genres that we associate as being indigenous to the U.S. in terms of their origins were created by African Americans and Native Americans. I mean, or at least the roots that mm-hmm. were put together and then create like the genres that emerge from these, you know, the drums and folk songs are completely non-white.
Right. And so
it's like, it really is like, it's hard because it's like the story of exploitation, but it's also kind of the soul of an American popular music. And
sure,
you can't.
Sure.
Yeah, no,
and when
absolutely.
You have, and when you are living in this completely oblivious, self-delusional, privileged, you know, racially privileged way, where you have to kind of be very dishonest with yourself with regard to your privileges, I think it starts to add up, and you might start acting really so crazy and put on an afro and start running around trying to be like Afro Lady in NYC. Well, you know, like. How do you explain that kind of crazy?
Well, the lady who wrote the blog, sort of commenting on it, put it wonderfully, if you don't mind me reading it out.
Yeah, please.
She says, wear it and keep it on you when your boyfriend or girlfriend asks you if you're really going out like that. When he or she tells you they prefer you long, blonde, and straight. Stick with it as your boss is gingerly looking for the politically correct way to tell you that your hairstyle is unprofessional and isn't properly representing the company. Keep it on after those smiling nods of approval you got when you were so clearly in costume give way to scowls, sneers, and giggles. Continue to wear it when people tell you you'd be so pretty if you did something different with your hair. And as you sit through all those Herbal Essences commercials that remind you that femininity is long, flowing, silky, and bouncy. And when you finally can't take it anymore and you want your long, straight hair back, keep the fro on, but slather your head in on a relaxer cream full of carcinogens that could very well kill you one day. I wonder how your outlook on life will change then.
Wow. She wrote that, and yeah. She reminds herself
well,
of
well, no. if only. The blogger, Brookie McPoverty, comments.
Brookie McPoverty?
That's her pseudonym. Her name is Tracy joking. Clayton, but she. I think she has like 5 blogs.
Oh, because she's like in like slumming it in Brooklyn, quote unquote.
No. This isn't the girl with the...
This is the blogger.
It's the one who was commenting on the girl with the fur. No. It's because she has like 5 blogs, and one of them is about
how
broke she is.
No, it's because sometimes the satire is so good, you can't tell.
It's not satire. Okay. It's not satire.
Okay, thank you. Sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, Alyssa, why did I talk?
No, it's all good.
Basically pointing out that it's like huge racial privilege for this woman to put on this kinky like fro made out of plastic and romp through the city, you know, on her part time.
Well, it's interesting. Angela Davis, when she was on the FBI's top 10 most wanted list, she said that she used to have to wear wigs to hide her afro because she was hiding from the FBI. They were trying to arrest her and jail her indefinitely. So it's just interesting. And we need to wrap up because we have a jam-packed show. So we are moving on.
You are listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio every last Wednesday of the month, only on CKUT 90.3.
Float straight out of our lids. Them, they got boo bodies, hard rock Brooklyn kids. Us, floor rush, when they DJ booming classics. You lick the crew on the fattest hip-hop record. He touched the kinks and sinks into the sounds. She frequents deep, fatter joints called undergrounds. Our funk zooms like you hit the Mary Jane. They flock to booms, man, boogie had to change. Who freaks the clips with mad amount percussion? Where kinky hair goes to unthought of dimensions? Why's it so fly? Cause hip-hop kept some drama. When butterfly rock the light blue suede pumas. What about a cut? We push it off the corner. How was the buzz entire hip-hop era? Was fresh in fact since they started saying Audi? Cause funk's made fat from right beneath my hood. The pooba of the styles like Miles and shit. Like 60s funky worms with waves and perms. Just sending junky rhythms right down your block. We beat to rap, what key beat to lock? But I'm cool like that. 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 I'm cool.
We be the chocolates, tats on my raps. She innovates after sweet and cat naps. He at the funk club with the vibrate. Them, they be crazy down with the 5 me. It can kick a plan, then a crowd burst. Me, I be digging it with the bug burst. Us, we be freaking till dawn, peace and eye. He gets a stranger smile, so I say hi.
What's up?
Who understood? Yeah, understood the plans. Hip heard a beat and put it to his hands. What I just flip, let borders get loose. How to consume all the beats just like juice. If it's the shit, we'll lift it off the plastic. The babes will go spastic. Hip hop is a classic. Pimp playing sharp, it don't matter. I'm fatter, axe butter, how I zone.
Man, Cleopatra Jones.
And I'm chill like that. 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 I'm chill.
I got crew kids, 7 and a crescent. Us cause a buzz when a nickel bends a dope. Him, that's my man with the asteroid belt. They catch a fizz from the Mr. Doodle Big. He rocks a teeth from the Crooklyn Nine Pigs. The rebirth of
super slick like my gangster stroll. The lyrics just like Luke coming stacks and rolls. You used to find the bug in a box with Fade. Now he boogies up your stage, plaits twist the braids. And I'm peace like that, 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 I'm peace.
Check it out, man, I groove like that, I'm smooth like that, I jive like that, I roll like that.
Yeah, I'm thick like that, I stack like that, I'm down like that, I'm black like that.
Yo, I funk like that, I'm fat like that, I'm in like that, cause I swing like that.
We jazz like that, we freak like that, we zoom like that, we out, we out, we out.
Jamaica, we leap away up a lot. The US of imperialist America. With whip bends, with legs, and of course with be my fear money and the drugs is where we are defense. Nobody back away. Wounds the fight against them enslavement. Kill off the damn English, Spanish, and French. Send them back where them come from. Get independence. United we stand, the divided must repent. United we stand, the divided must repent. Divided must repent. Where the British leave off, the Americans start. Once a new playground in Cuba, kicking the rust. Going all around the world, selling American dreams.
Welcome back to CKUT 90.3 FM. It is 6:36. This is Nyx here on the mic. I've got a little poem for you. This is a personal alright, so we'll just wing this and hope that you can hear. My skin is a false division. There is her, my mother's determined chin. My skin is a false division. There is him, my father's brooding grim. My mind is a split illusion. There is her, mi madre's perseverance. My mind is a split illusion. There is him, mi padre's wholesome compassion. My mind, my blood is a yin-yang mix. There is her, easily frantic. My blood is a white-black mix. There is him, simply didactic. We were driving someplace, somewhere, sometime, on a rainy highway, driving somewhere, someplace. I told my ma, me, as a mother, I would not want to bear white children. Me ma, she stopped the car and said, daughter, from where comes this hate? We were driving somewhere, someplace, on a rainy highway. Me ma said, daughter, love in this world ain't got nothing to do with race. As I'm driving my body through these life lanes, I got to say, ma, we live in a world where our imaginations are colonized as much as our faces, and we would be naive to say love ain't got nothing to do with race. Tell me what is a child to do when she ain't got no love for herself, because she is never going to be fair-skinned, a lighter race. Tell me, what is a gal to do when she ain't got no love for herself, because she's always going to feel the shadow of a majority place. Tell me, what is a woman to do when she ain't got no love for herself, because she's always going to be ethnic, exotic, cast somewhere between semi-brown and a sort of white face? Me, I ain't no clear division between multiple ethnic dimensions. I am the daughter of a kind-hearted man. I am the daughter of a strong-willed woman. And I will never tell my white, black, brown, yellow, pink, gray, green child that it ain't got nothing to do with race. In a world where we are all constantly racing to the top to top one another, clambering over each other, I will embrace myself as a woman with my fellow women, raise my voice, and be proud of all of my dimensions.
Us cause a buzz when a nickel bets a dope. Him, that's my man with the asteroid belt. Fate catch a fizz from the Mr. Doodle Big. He rocks a teeth from the Crooklyn Nine Pigs. The rebirth is slick like my gangster stroll. The lyrics just like Luke come in stacks and rolls. You used to find the bug in a box with Fade. Now he boogies up your stage, plats twist the braids. And I'm peace like that. 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 Check it out, man, I groove like that. I'm smooth like that. I jive like that. I roll like that.
Yeah, I'm thick like that. I stack like that. I'm down like that. I'm black
like that. Yeah, is there a remix? So we're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM Montreal.
The 2110 Center for Gender Advocacy and CKUT present The Dragon Root Project, a year-long workshop series on gendered violence. Join us every second Wednesday from 6 to 8 p.m. at 1500 de Maisonneuve West, room 404.
Our next workshop on December 5th will be Our Bodies, Our Choice, Reproductive Justice and Systemic Violence with the Reproductive Justice League. This workshop will discuss the meaning of reproductive justice and will highlight the historic and current state of abortion access and other reproductive rights in Quebec and Canada.
For information on other workshops in the series, visit center2110.org or email campaigns at center2110.org.
Kuramaha, directed by Kathy Kennedy, and the Monday Night Choir, directed by Nathan Gage, present Double Shot, an evening of 21st century choral music to celebrate the release of Kuramaha's new CD, Songs from Silence. Join us for an evening that celebrates the beauty and power of voices collectively raised in song, followed by a night of DJs and dancing on Saturday, December 8th at the Ukrainian Federation at 5213 Hutchison, Montreal. Tickets are available for $15 at the door and $12 for students and seniors. Visit kuramaha.org for more information. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
We pledge resistance.
What's up? This is Saul Williams chilling here in Montreal here on CKUT.
We pledge alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war.
Debbie Young is a Jamaican womanist, warrior artist, internationally celebrated for her unapologetic, explosive consciousness on the mic. A second-generation dub poet whose mother, Anita Stewart, is one of the pioneers of the genre. Debbie's lyricism emerges from the roots of dub, entwined with the rhythms of dancehall, reggae, hip-hop, punk rock, and dubstep. Her performance art is a banyan tree of theatricality, with branches extending across cultural boundaries and social norms, springing into revolution. She has headlined festivals in Cuba, South Africa, Swaziland, Spain, Jamaica, Canada, the UK, America, and France. Debbie is the published author of 2 collections of poetry, 4 plays, 6 albums, and is the originator of the Biomis or Plusi methodology. Her latest CD, 333, is a love letter to all dancehall queens, queers, and questioners of the status quo. Earlier this month, Debbie was in Montreal as part of her 333 global tour. We caught up with her and asked her about her inspirations, her preparations, how she navigates the art world, and all while staying healthy.
Such a pleasure and an honor to be here at the 2110 Center for Gender Advocacy interviewing the legendary poet Debbie Young. Debbie, how are you doing today?
I'm legendary. Dun, 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 dun. I'm doing well. Having a beautiful, beautiful day. I'm in a wonderful mood coming out of last night's performance.
And by legendary, I don't mean old. I just mean legendary. just clarifying that. Debbie, I have so much I want to talk to you about. I guess I first want to start by asking you to just take us back to the beginning. Where did it start for you? It can be whatever you want it to be. Why did this life take you to this place? Why did you become the artist that you are now? And where do you think the journey that you embarked upon began in the way that it did?
I feel like when I think of that question, I can answer it on so many levels. I'm just beginning to learn about quantum physics and the fact that all the atoms in our bodies are recycled from, you know, all the atoms that have ever existed, which have also been in the bodies of all the most wonderful revolutionaries and philosophers and mystics and witches and warlocks and magicians. So where did it begin? I don't know. But if I think about the legacy of my mother, then it began with my mother, you know, who had me at 15 and who became a dub poet herself and one of the pioneer dub poets. And you can imagine her having me that early. It was like growing up with my sister for a lot of it. So we lived with my grandmother and my mom's other aunts who also had children. So I grew up with a whole bunch of cousins, even though I was an only child. And we grew up in a working class neighborhood, Shortwood Lane, for like the first 7 years of my life. Then we moved to Maxfield Avenue, which is like another working class neighborhood, just neighboring Trenchtown. So I grew up among people who had to work for a living, you know, people who had children, families that were living in close community, both blood-related community and non-blood-related community, and also a neighborhood that was rife with violence. So all of that mixed together creates this really dramatic reality, you know? And so I had drama in that sense, and then I had drama through poetry and drama through theater, drama through the pantomime of Jamaica, and all kinds of art and dance and music is all around. So children who grew up in Jamaica are artists, even if they don't are not professionals at it. Then, as I grew older, I thought that dub poetry particularly was attractive because it was talking about the poor people, and I was poor, so it was talking about me. And at home, we were having all kinds of like contradictions around the importance of the girl child and the girl child's role in the family and the woman's role in the family. And you can imagine, like every other young person, I was trying to find myself, you know, not seeing myself necessarily reflected and validated at home all the time, sometimes, but not all the time. I turned to dub because my mother was doing dub. And she had all this, like, eyes on her and validation from doing dub, you know? So dub always made sense because I could always see myself in it and it always had room for me to speak. That, I feel, sets the foundation, you know? As I grew older and continued to, like, navigate myself, my role in a Canadian society, I moved here when I was 15, I drifted away from Jamaica and dub and all that part of my life represented because there's so much pain that came with it as well. And Canada presented this like way of escape by total assimilation. And so for the first 4 years, I experimented with that. Like, what would it be to completely immerse yourself, particularly linguistically, in a culture, you know? So I developed this interesting accent. And I remember living in Montreal, having left Toronto, moved to Montreal to go to McGill, having a conversation with a dear friend and mentor of mine, Dave Austin, who was like, why do you have that accent? I tell this story repeatedly because in my mind, it signifies a pivotal moment in my life at around 1920, where I was really asked the question embedded was, who are you? How are you? And what is your purpose? And those three questions are the three questions that I live by now, you know? Dub, art making, art activism, art education, for me, is my way of affecting revolution. You know, and I think my entire life I've been moving through different stages of realizing that. You know, it makes the most sense to me. That's why I do it.
For somebody who has never heard of your work, has never seen you perform, has never explored or been able to explore the themes and the intensity that your work is, how would you describe it to them?
It feels to me in my own body that I'm sitting by a tree with my grandmother who is telling me a story. And I remember some of those moments, I would really get to experience and inner experience the movement and the emotions of these characters. If she was telling me about Anansi, the spider, I could see myself either somewhere in the jungle watching Anansi or embodying Anansi and moving through all the things that he was doing. So it feels to me like that is what I am able to share with people, is what my grandmother was able to share with me, which is like using your entire body, using your eyes, using your language, using this invisible energy that is being reciprocated between the storyteller and the village, using all of that so that each member of the village who's witnessing the story gets to go on a personal journey, where they then, somewhere in the act of listening, they then begin to reflect on themselves. So they're watching the performer, but it's not just about watching the performer. It's also about, who am I? What has happened to me? What have I done with those things? What do I do to people? What do I want to do? What is my potential for fullness and wholeness? And it's crucial for me that while people are experiencing the story, that they experience themselves, not just experience me. And I think that that's what I do. I help people to experience themselves through the work that I do. You know, it's really quite accessible and simple. Because I think also too, as storytellers, we have to make our processes accessible to people so that it doesn't seem like some kind of highfalutin, convoluted mess of a inaccessible reality that's up on a pedestal. It's like old school storytelling. That's what it is. And I think it comes off the way it does for people because it's something that we're doing less and less. You know, so when you experience something as a rarity, you know, you then begin to appreciate it. But the fact that something's popular doesn't mean that it has to be non-sacred. Do you know what I'm saying? So storytelling can be a popular people's art, like it has always been, and still be sacred. And I think when people experience the energy within the space that we co-create, they also experience the sacred, which makes it feel so magical. But the sacred is within all of us. Like, and unless it was within all of us, we couldn't create that space together in, like, let's say, like last night at La Sala Rosa. That's because each person is adding an energy of sacredness to the environment. So then it really does fill the room, and it helps me to tell the story, but it also helps the audience to experience the story as well, you know? But it's old school.
Who amongst us carries the sage secrets of loving? Where are our elders, our children? the ones who walk with the all-time knowledge of a healing love, an unapologetic love, an uncompromising love, an honest love.
This might lead well into my next question, which is, I think I've attended maybe 7 or 8 of your performances, each one just as intense as the one before. And I don't mean intense in an amorphous way. I mean, I just don't know how else to describe it. But I'm always struck by the pointed reactions and the way the reactions move, either from absolute silence and concentration, could hear a pin drop, to chants, to ambiguity, and each one moves, and it's fluid. It comes back to silence. It comes back to cheering. Sometimes people check out because it's a little just too intense, and it takes them to a place that they're not able to go to right now. And I guess my question is, as a performer, how does that affect your art? How you perceive your art? And are you concerned with the way people react if people are able to attend to what you are, through your storytelling, presenting them?
I think the first thing that's crucial for me to acknowledge is the fact that people come into the room already, for me, is such a huge honor to witness. The fact that the person, the individual, chooses is a very big deal. I try to take the stage seriously and sacredly, and it's important for me that each audience member feels that. So we're mutually accountable and responsible for each other. There's a lot of accountability and responsibility within the joy, but it's crucial for you to know that I'm gonna do my very best to make the storytelling session as interesting and engaging and challenging and intriguing and magical as I possibly can. Like, those, I think about those things. They don't just happen accidentally. They happen magically, in the sense that I cannot control or manipulate them, that the best thing that I can do is to meditate before a show so that the energy can flow, because I can't control it. I can't, you know, when I start to get involved in those things, like being a younger performer earlier in my career, trying to figure out how to negotiate the energy that comes off the audience and comes off me, and like thinking it's about control or I want to make it this way. Now it's like the process of meditating, I think, for the storyteller, of preparing yourself, allows then for the emergence of an organic, magical energy that you cannot know is going to happen before the show. I can never know how it's going to go. But what I have noticed is that the more I prepare, the more I meditate, the more that I look at my own self-knowledge, my own orality, my own rhythm, political content, context. These are principles that I use. Language of communication, the urgency, the sacredness, and the integrity in my work. And I use those principles every day. They impact me. I question them. I name them, you know. The more that I do that and actually take the time in the day or days before, weeks before, months before, to prepare for the storytelling session, 100% the show goes phenomenally. Because the storyteller is a conduit, and everybody in the room is like conducting energy, but the storyteller, given the nature of storytelling, one person is speaking, many people are listening, even if they're responding, given the nature of that, the storyteller is a conduit for the energy that's moving in the room, you know, to be able to conduct that energy along with the rest of the members of the room. It's like, it's an involved process, you know, it's a very involved process. And the older I get, the more I realize how involved it is, and simple it is, that all I have to do is get out the way. Like, all I have to do is be clear in my own body, and the show, with my intention, with my clear intention of loving the audience or loving myself or bringing a message of love, that unfolds in the show. And I'm just learning that the older I get. There is fiction in the space between.
We're going to have to leave it there. Unfortunately, we're short for time this month, but we will air that interview in full next month. And we will also put it on our blog, spitfire.blogspot.com. And hopefully we will, once we send it to Debbie herself, she'll have it up on her website, maybe.
That brings us to the end of the show. A big shout out to everyone who made it to the studio today, as well as a thank you to everyone that contributed pieces. Big love to Malek and Yasmin for their amazing work this month too.
Also, a shout out to my ladies, Mae Nam and Alicia Morrison and Katie Lee. Hope you enjoyed the music this time round. Lots of love from Montreal.
Spitfire, Women of Color Radio, broadcasts every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on CKUT Radio 90.3 FM. You can write to us at spitfire@ckut.ca and check out www.spitfire.blogspot.com. Peace!
Most just wanna get high from the cradle to the grave. Don't wanna be your slave, and I'm not gonna take it how you wanna. Love me or hate me, support me or snake me. Either way, I show love. Let it make me or break me. I'm the queen of self-esteem. Don't sweat the cream, just set the scene. Get screamed like how you mean. Straight up, one of the best that's been. Ain't no puppet on a string. Like them hoes sucking on your thing. Overworked and underpaid for days. Behave, I'm not gonna be your slave. People screaming hardcore, living in the ghetto, sleeping on the floor. What you thought I was gonna rise? Do my thing, get my piece of the pie. You're holding your breath for great God out of the sky. Best live your life, cause you just waiting to die. People still taking life for a joke. Can't see the fire, but you blow a lot of smoke. If you didn't get it, you got what you deserve. Just like that, that's my word. Every day I wake up, scheming on the come up. No daydreaming, got to stay one up. How you gonna sit back and wait on the wealth? Gotta go get it, motivate yourself. If not, you only perpetrate yourself. And at the end of the day, you only hate yourself. If you know me, you know my motto. Take in charge, you got what it takes to make it all. The world got a problem, and it's yours. That's why I wrote this rhyme. You can quote this line, cause I focus line. Living in some hopeless times, or so it seems. Never let go of your dreams, nah, man. Nah, man. Just do what you got to do.